Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Jan Dawson, Chief Analyst at Jackdaw Research. Jan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Thank you for being on the show with me.
Yeah, good to be here too.
I've been wanting to have you on the show for a while. It's always fun to listen to the perspectives of analysts. And in that vein, I wanted to ask you, how does one get to be an analyst?
Yeah, and I think the first important thing to say there is there are two different kinds of analysts, and it's important to be clear about which kind I am. So there are financial analysts who work for big banks and so on and who have ratings on stocks and that kind of thing, and then there are what are called industry analysts, and I'm actually one of those. And so it's important to be clear about the differences between those two. Financial analysts' main job is to evaluate the stocks of companies and ultimately to give advice on whether people should buy or sell them. My job as an industry analyst is actually to serve the industry. So my clients are not people who are buying and selling stocks, but my clients are companies in the tech industry itself. And so that includes several of the largest consumer technology companies in the world. My job is to evaluate the companies, their strategies, their business model, and that kind of thing, and to make recommendations to those companies and to make observations about them, you know, in public, whether that's blog posts or podcasts or whatever else. And so I'm that kind of an analyst. I've been that kind of an analyst for about 15 years at this point. I started at a company in the UK, which is where I'm from, called Ovum, and I worked there for about 13 years. And then for the last 2 years, I've been doing it on my own with my firm, Jackdaw Research.
What brought you to the U.S., if I may ask?
Yeah, my wife's from the U.S. So she came to the U.S. She came from the U.S. to the U.K. She grew up in New York and then came to the U.K. to do a master's degree. And so we met during the time that she was in London and got married right before she finished. And she wrote her thesis when we should have been on our honeymoon. And then we took a longer honeymoon later when we had a bit more time. But yeah, we got married, lived there for another couple of years after that. But her family was here in the U.S., and so she wanted to be closer to them. And I was at a point in my career where I'd had a couple of interesting roles in the firm that I was working for, felt like I wanted a new challenge, and a new geography was an interesting challenge to deal with. And so I'd been covering the U.S. quite a bit in the space that I was in, and so it was great to have an opportunity to move to the U.S. and cover it from on the ground.
Now, I noticed from our coordination efforts, you're in the same time zone I'm in. I'm in
That's
Colorado.
Right.
You're in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
How does one get from UK to Utah?
Yeah, in three steps is the simple answer. So, my wife, as I say, she grew up in New York and her family were there. So when we first moved to the U.S., we wanted to be in New York too, but the company I was working for only had an office in Boston. So they said, well, you can be in Boston if you want to be. So we thought, well, that's fine. We moved here, and then my wife's dad, who'd worked in advertising for 20 years in Manhattan, was laid off from his job. He got to the point where it was a lot cheaper for them to hire a bunch of junior guys rather than keeping him on. And so he happened to get a job teaching at a university out here. And so they moved out here about 11 years ago now, I guess. And so we were in Boston for a few years. We did end up moving down to New Jersey to be a bit closer to New York and other members of her family. And then ultimately, a couple of years ago, we moved out here to Utah. And obviously, there was a family draw with her family being here. She has her parents and several siblings here. But it was also, I was doing more and more work with companies on the West Coast, Silicon Valley, that kind of area. Mm-hmm. And so this was a great way to be, you know, a short flight away from that set of clients that I had in the Silicon Valley area, while still having kind of the cost of living and everything else that goes with living in the West, but not necessarily the far West.
Do you ski?
I do, although it's funny. For the first year that we were here, I hadn't skied. And so every time I would say I'm based in Utah, the first question everybody would ask, ski.
Of course.
And I did ski as a kid, as a teenager. So my family and I went skiing about every year for about 10 years from when I was about 6 to about 16. And then I got to the age where I wasn't interested in going on vacation with my parents anymore. And so I didn't go then for about 20 something years. And then when we moved here, everybody kept asking me and I thought, fine, better start getting back into it again. So last Christmas, we got into it again. My parents were out here and my parents are avid skiers still. So went out with my parents and my kids took some lessons. And so we've been carrying that on this year. And this has been a great year for skiing. We've had lots of snow. So it's been nice.
Oh, yeah. Same here in Colorado. Are you a skier or a rider?
I'm a skier. Yeah.
Yeah. People who learn to ski somehow, I'm a skier, somehow have an affection for skis and don't really get motivated to switch over to snowboarding.
Yeah. Well, I was on a lift with somebody the other day and talking about this, and he's primarily a skier, and he was saying the bad thing about skiing is you're so good at it that if you try snowboarding, unless you stick with it for several days, it's just utterly demoralizing. You fall over the time. Like, why am I putting myself through this? I just want to go back to skiing again. And so he said you have to stick with it for two or three times before you kind of start to feel comfortable and feel like it's worthwhile, apparently. So
awesome. So Jackdaw Research, tell us about how you dreamed up that name. And any other people you work with?
Sure. So, I was at Ovum, the company I was at for 13 years. I'd done a lot of different things there. And I was a telecoms analyst, first and foremost.
What does a telecoms analyst do?
So cover big carriers. So whether it's wireline type carriers or whether it's wireless carriers. And for the last several years, my focus is mostly on the wireless carriers here in the US. But basically covering those companies, their strategies, the trends, you know, collecting a lot of data about those companies, both public and potentially private data, and digesting that and drawing some conclusions about their business and feeding those conclusions back to them in the form of strategic recommendations. So a lot of those carriers were clients at that time. But, you know, we had a telecoms business and an IT business where some of our analysts covered enterprise IT. And yet the telecoms business was getting more and more caught up in smartphones and things like that. So you couldn't really cover telecoms without understanding smartphones and tablets and all the trends that were going on there and the increasing power that was going to those players rather than carriers, and the fact that the carriers were being kind of relegated to being dumb pipes, effectively.
Apple played a role in that.
Apple certainly played a role in that, yes. And so, you know, through all of that, we felt the need to do more coverage of that space. And so we had a devices team that covered some of that area. And so I became closer and closer to that team in my last couple of years at Ovum, and was kind of the US arm of that team, along with other responsibilities that I had, including running all of our telecoms research globally. So I kind of did it in my spare time to some extent, you could say. But, you know, I became more and more interested in consumer technology and the trends there and the way that, you know, players that normally come from different spaces, whether that's carriers or smartphone vendors or online service providers, were kind of converging in the set of things that they were offering and competing with each other, where in the past they might have had complementary roles. And so really started covering more and more of that kind of convergence, the competition between these players and how that was shifting and how the dynamics were shifting and how they were competing for customers. And so started covering more and more of that, but I was in a management role there where, you know, most of my time was taken up with management type stuff, which is a lot of internal meetings and that kind of thing. And I wanted to get back to being a pure analyst again. And so I'd always wanted to kind of have my own firm, and the opportunity kind of presented itself towards the end of 2013 to leave and to do that. And so that's when I started this firm. It's just me. I'm self-employed, and it's a single person firm at the moment. You know, I'd love to grow that in future, but right now it's just me. The name is sort of a play on my own name, which kind of backfires on me sometimes because people think my first name is Jack, or they think my last name is Door, or both. And so, but you know, I when you come to naming a company, especially a company that's really built around yourself and your skill set, you kind of have several options. You can go with the kind of self-naming, so you kind of call it, you know, Dawson Research or whatever. That always feels a bit self-important to me, and I didn't want to do that. You can go with something that's completely different, you know, the Starbucks model. You know, you just pick a name that you like that has nothing to do with what you're doing, or you go descriptive, so like Business Technology Research Inc. or whatever, and that just felt like a bit of a mouthful and didn't really feel like I wanted to do that. And so in
kind
the end, I kind of
went
with a...
Old-fashioned. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nobody does that anymore.
Yeah. So I figured I'd kind of go with a combination of sort of a play on my name and then... you know, something that didn't necessarily mean anything, but that was easy to remember and short and so on. And so Jackdaw is a member of the crow family. If you've seen my logo, it's, you know, it's a crow essentially outline with the name across it. And so, yeah, it is a thing. It's a real thing. But it's also a play on my name to that extent.
Yeah. How many times do people say, well, you're Dawson, where's Jack?
Yeah. More often people call me Jack. That's the thing that happens more frequently.
I'm curious about your telecom analysis phase when you were providing feedback to them and how they compete and fight for customers. How did that go in terms of acceptance of your assessment of the competitive situation? Do the carriers really think they have a good handle on providing great customer service and great communications capabilities and great reasons why people should be with them? Or is it more callous than that? Is it sort of like just a, you know, grinding away at the hemorrhaging and getting new customers and stealing new customers and losing old ones and consumer services upsetting customers and saying, well, we just roll with that? I mean, tell me about your perceptions about how they greeted these analyses.
Yeah, it depended on the carrier as a simple answer. So some of them were more enlightened than others, to be sure. So some of them were very much aware of kind of how their customers really saw them and were trying to change that. Others were perhaps in denial for longer. I would say that in general, the carrier industry does tend to be very up on itself, does tend to be quite arrogant. You know, these are very, very large companies that, you know, have huge numbers of customers that control very important parts of our daily lives. And so they can become very self-important and very self-aggrandizing and can be very self-deluded at the same time in terms of their importance and their role and how customers perceive them and the services that they provide. And so, yeah, it was oftentimes you were pushing quite hard against the client to kind of say, hey, you guys need to stop acting like this and you need to start realizing kind of the dangers to your business. Because the other thing is these companies were used to competing against other similar companies. They didn't think of, you know, smartphone vendors as competitors. They thought of them as sort of suppliers, essentially suppliers right. of hardware that then drove sales. And so, you know, it took a long time for them to start realizing, actually, we need to see these companies as quasi-competitors as well, because they're going to be sucking in a lot of the budget that we're going after as well with, you know, mobile music services, mobile TV services, and so on. You know, those were a thing a few years back. And you know, they never really took off, in part because these smartphone platforms took over a lot of that market over time with content and so on. And so, but yeah, you know, they're notoriously bad at customer service. They're all trying to improve that. They tend to try to use technology to help them to improve these things. And the problem is that all the carriers ultimately, until very recently at least, have all bought the same kind of equipment from the same small set of companies. So they buy, you know, large servers effectively that run the network from companies like Ericsson or Lucent and others. And as a result, they all tend to basically follow the same path in terms of technology deployment. It's a very long cycle of deployment, which means they move very slowly. They're some of the least nimble companies you'll ever find, because, you know, you basically have to have a roadmap 3 years out for technology that you're going to deploy, and then you deploy it, and then mm-hmm. you know, turn on a feature, and you have to plan that months in advance. And so a lot of the innovation in telecoms has been behind the scenes in terms of shortening those cycles, in terms of moving from buying huge hardware to drive functionality in the network to deploying software to drive functionality in the network, and moving to software-style life cycles for products and deployment times, and also to being able to open up APIs for developers and that kind of thing as well, which you can do once your network is software-based rather than just hardware-based. So there's a lot of innovation going on, but a lot of it's behind the scenes and a lot of it isn't immediately obvious to customers. But it should drive more sort of nimbleness, more sort of faster deployment for new features and that kind of thing. But the carriers are still fairly early in that, even though they've been talking about it for years.
How do you feel? I want to just get off the track here a second. How do you feel about, I think it was Verizon. I read an article the other day that noted that they don't impose data caps for their own music services or other services, but they do impose caps for, say, Netflix.
Yeah,
what's so going on there? Is that legal, or does that violate the spirit of net neutrality? Or
is
that
question.
Just
so yeah, Verizon launched a few months ago now this video service called Go90, and it's the weird thing about it is it's launched by Verizon Wireless, but it's not exclusive to Verizon Wireless customers. So anybody can download the app. It's available for iOS and for Android. But this past week, I think on Friday, they released an update to the app that said, if you stream video through the app, it's free now, basically, if you're a Verizon Wireless customer. And so, you know, this seems on the face of it to violate these sort of principles of net neutrality because you're treating your own content preferentially. And some people have pushed back on that already. The press has kind of hit them pretty hard over it. And one of the responses that they provided was, well, we launched a product a while back. For anybody who wants to provide content over our network, they can sponsor the data associated with that. AT&T has a similar model. Basically, what it means is if you're a Netflix or whoever, you can pay the customer's bill for when they're consuming your content such that it doesn't show up on their bill. And so Verizon's saying, well, we opened this up a while ago to anybody who wants to use it, and now we're using it ourselves. And so basically, Verizon is paying Verizon to do this. And so that's why this is okay in their mind. This is why it doesn't violate net neutrality because it's an open system that anybody else could to take advantage of too. You know, the obvious counter argument is it's not very transparent. You can say you're paying yourself internally, but is there really actually any money moving from one right. division of Verizon to another? Right. And you know, well, how is
create a division if you need to.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, so that's an interesting sort of brouhaha that I think will be interesting to watch over the next little while, because you know, people have pushed back against some of the stuff T-Mobile's done recently, much to you know the CEO's annoyance, because he's generally a net neutrality fan. But this is the problem with net neutrality, is once it's out there, people have their own interpretations of what it means, and yeah. it's very easy to fall afoul of those.
Interesting. Okay, so it's time to take a short break right now. When we return, I want to ask you about your thoughts on Apple and a little bit about Google, and I want to talk to you about your notion called PadOS, which I love. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we are back. Thank you, Kelly. Okay, we'd only have about 15 minutes left in the show. But I do want to ask you about Apple and its stock. There was a time when things were not a whole lot different than they are now in terms of the structure of Apple and their products, and yet their stock was selling at $130 a share. And then all of a sudden the bottom dropped out of Apple for apparently no good reason other than the price of oil. How do you feel about Apple now versus when the stock was higher? And how do you feel about what Apple's doing? Tim Cook had to have a town hall meeting to kind of cheer up the employees last week. What do you think's going on?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's all about the iPhone, right? So, you know, the Apple results in general and their stock price in turn are driven by what's going on with the iPhone. It's just so dominant in terms of their revenues and their profits. And so when, you know, to borrow an old analogy, you know, when the iPhone sneezes, Apple catches a cold. You know, so given that iPhone sales are pretty much flat year on year for the first time ever, and that they're forecast to be down fairly significantly this coming quarter for the first time ever, that's really what's hit the stock price. And the reason it started falling before Apple reported its results is that there were signs that this was going to happen, and so analysts were starting to bake that into their valuations for Apple, the stock. The challenge is that, you know, the stock's getting hit over something that's happening over a period of a couple of quarters, whereas really stock valuations should reflect long-term views about a company and mm-hmm. kind of its trajectory and where it's going. And so if you look at Apple, the company, if you look at what's likely to be the long-term trajectory, both for iPhone sales and for its other products and for revenues and all the other financial metrics, it still looks incredibly positive to me. You know, I'm very bullish on Apple over the long term. The challenge is they're going through a year in which a year ago they had massive, massive results off the back of the iPhone 6. And the iPhone 6 kind of opened up a whole set of new markets for them, a whole set of new opportunities around higher smartphone sales because of the larger iPhone for the first time that was more competitive against Android devices and so on. And so they're just basically facing really tough year-on-year comparisons against that amazing year they had a year before. Once we get through the anniversary of those enormous kind of upgrade cycles that happened a year ago, things will start to smooth out, and I think the growth will start to head back up again, both in iPhones and for the company as a whole. And so I'm not worried about Apple. I'm obviously, if I was an investor, I'd be worried about the share price in the short term, but I think long term it should be fine. I think it's just that we're going through a period where analysts in particular have always been very skittish about Apple. Whenever there's a sign that something's going wrong with the iPhone or that growth isn't what they hoped it would be, they tend to overreact.
Why do you think that is?
I think it ultimately comes down to a couple of things. I think, you know, Apple is ultimately a hit-driven business. And so unlike, say, a Google or a Facebook or an Amazon where, you know, there's no single product that kind of drives their results, where it's a whole series of things that are on fairly predictable trajectories. Apple's results are overwhelmingly driven by a few hit products, and especially by the iPhone that comes out once a year, and that's inherently, to these analysts at least, unpredictable quite how good next year's iPhone is going to be and how well it's going to perform. And so, you know, if you look at, as stock analysts do, you look at kind of valuations on the basis of, you know, the stock or the company is worth a multiple of current earnings, for example, you know, Apple's way undervalued. And I think the discount is just because of that unpredictability involved with having a single annual kind of hit product that, in theory at least, could always turn out to be not very good. Of course, in practice, it always has been very good and has driven very healthy upgrade cycles among the iPhone base. But there's always that worry with Apple that something could go wrong. I think the other thing that analysts worry about with Apple is just that there's some magic involved. Like, you know, analysts, financial analysts love their spreadsheets. They love putting every little thing down on in a spreadsheet cell that they can measure and say, okay, this is going at this pace, this is going at that pace, and this is why Apple's going to win. And, you know, Apple prices its products higher than others, doesn't target certain parts of the market. You know, it really puts a premium on its products. It refuses to lower its prices. And yet, you know, here's this piece of hardware that has very much the same components as this other piece of hardware over here. And as a financial analyst, I have a very hard time putting in a spreadsheet why Apple sells more of these pieces of hardware than somebody else does.
But there's so much lore, and there's so much hundreds of millions of words have been written. Books have been written. People like Leander Caney and Mr. Levy have analyzed and explained to us in depth how Apple works. Do they not read these books and understand the culture and the psyche of Apple?
I think ultimately you can't put that stuff in a spreadsheet. And that sounds pejorative and it sounds ridiculously oversimplified, but this is the challenge with Apple financial analysts, is they can't put that into a spreadsheet. And so there's this sort of magic, basically, that they can't quantify and that they refuse to believe is really real and can really justify this kind of continued loyalty to Apple on the part of customers and the continued kind of drive of new products that are always, you know, fantastic. And so, you know, I think there's just a part of these financial analysts that just can't quite quantify it. And so they can't build it into these models that they have. And, you know, that makes it really tough for them to justify, you know, these higher share prices. And then you have, you know, unfortunately, this affects all stocks with this very short-termist approach to stocks, where it's all about the current quarter. We've had a whole range of companies over the last few weeks that have reported, you know, either poor results or have given guidance that was lower than people expected. GoPro is one, LinkedIn is another one, and their stock's been absolutely hammered because of next quarter's guidance. You know, forget about the long-term picture; it's all about the current quarter. And so, I think that affects Apple disproportionately as well.
Do you think? I don't want to probe too deep into your analysis, Jab, but do you want to speculate about whether you think the iPhone 7 will make all things good again with two cameras and inductive or remote charging, and all will be forgiven, or do you think it'll take longer?
Yeah, I think it will. During the iPhone 7 cycle is probably when the iPhone will return to decent growth again. Whether that's, you know, in September or whether that's in the December quarter or March next year or whatever it might be, sometime in that cycle is when it's going to return to growth. And it's interesting, if you strip out the last year and just look at the trajectory for iPhone sales up until the 6 launched, you know, you see this trajectory and we're kind of back on that trajectory again. The problem is we had this massive bump in between with the iPhone 6 that just totally distorted that line. And so if you strip that out and look back at the direction the line was going in before the iPhone 6 launched, it was very healthy. And then you add in, you know, the new markets that Apple's able to target right now with these larger phones, with being in China in a bigger way through China Mobile, through being better in India. You know, there's lots of reasons. And, you know, the record level of Android switches that Tim Cook talks about, the fact that the base is bigger all the time. And so got more people to upgrade, and only 40% of them are upgraded so far to either 6 or 6 Plus. You know, so many reasons to believe that there's going to be a huge continuing iPhone upgrade cycle and switching cycle ahead of us. It's just a matter of getting through that anniversary of that huge bump. And I think once we do, I think things will settle down and I think you'll return to growth. It won't be 30% growth. It'll probably be in the single digits, maybe 10% in a good year.
I wrote once that the iPhone is a never-ending process and product. This device, which we hold in our hands and we communicate to the world, it's going to continue to expand and develop forever. It may change in the way we touch it. It may change in the way we view it with virtual reality or something floating in space. It may change in its physical manifestation. It may end up being in our pockets instead of in our hands, and then we just simply have it projection in space, or something's overlaid on our optic nerve, or whatever. But the future of this kind of personal access to the internet and communication is almost limitless, and it's a product that's never going to die. It's going to change a lot. Mm-hmm. But it's always going to be the thing that we carry around with us that connects us. And
yeah.
So I think there's, as Apple continues to develop the technology and invent new things and patent new ideas, it'll continue to evolve and it'll just keep growing and growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the key is for Apple to continue to invest in the things that are going to be peripherals to the iPhone, whether that's, you know, something like the Apple Watch and other wearables, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, you mentioned sort of virtual reality and other screens. I think it's really important that Apple invest in that stuff too, because you're going to want a close tie between those technologies and the device that you're carrying around with you.
Now, when I got my iPad Pro, I had the distinct feeling that this was a serious chunk of hardware. That A9X processor in there is very capable. And with the picture-in-picture and some of the other features that it has, you kind of get the feeling that the hardware is very, very good, but iOS isn't really quite up to the task in some ways in exploiting the power of the hardware. And then I read your article, I think it was at tech.pinions, about your concept for what you call Pad OS. Explain that.
Yeah, so this is off the back of a lot of reviews that came out when the iPad Pro was first released, which really focused on the fact that it was a great device in many ways, but that it didn't really seem optimized for, you know, having a keyboard and having a pen and the Apple Pencil, and, you know, the other things that are kind of unique to the iPad Pro. And what it really felt like to me was that the device was being held back by the fact that it had to run iOS rather than kind of having its own identity. And if you look at the other new devices that Apple's launched recently, you know, the Apple Watch runs watchOS, the Apple new Apple TV, the fourth generation one runs tvOS, and yet, you know, the iPad Pro runs iOS. And of course, iOS started life as iPhone OS, and that's very much the heritage. And it's worked very well for the iPad, arguably, until now. But, you know, the iPad Pro is so different. It's so much larger. It's designed to work in a very tightly integrated way with a smart keyboard and the pencil. And yet it's very much kind of tied down to the iOS models and the interaction models and everything else. And it feels like if you were trying to invent the iPad Pro from scratch today and figure out, okay, what does the operating system look like that works with this device? Why would you assume that an OS that you first designed for a smartphone would be the one? You
know,
why wouldn't you say, right, exactly. I mean, you know, iOS has evolved, so it's not exactly the version that debuted in 2007, but, you know, clearly, you know, this came out of a certain heritage. And if you're designing an OS for, you know, this much larger device that has these new capabilities, that has these accessories that are designed to work specifically with it, you know, why would you assume that iOS is the way to go? Now, there are obvious reasons for assuming that. You know, it means you get to tap into the App Store and everything else that Apple's built around iOS, you know, the developer base and everything. But it also means that you're constrained. You can't stray too far from what people expect iOS to be and how they expect it to behave, because it's jarring. But if you call it something different, as they did with tvOS, which has a same kind of core code base but a different user interface, or watchOS that borrows some of the same code base but looks very different, you know, design an OS that's really optimized for this form factor. And I think if you were to change the name, it gives you the freedom as the team at Apple working on this to say what is best for this device, not kind of we can't stray too far from the rest of iOS because it will break things. You know, we need to design the OS that's best for this device. So that's really that, what that piece was about.
I think that's an excellent perception. And I have been championing that and everything I write about. I think I've mentioned you at least three or four times in various articles I've written. Pad OS, a fabulous concept. I love it. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you one more jackpot question. There are lots of people who feel like Google competes with Apple because it's dreams up some fascinating ideas and seems to be a futuristic company. And yet it doesn't do the kind of hardware we're familiar with Apple and the legacy. How do you see the competitive situation between these two companies, if you see one at all?
Yeah, well, this really goes back to a point I made earlier in our conversation about convergence. You know, these players that came from different heritages and yet have come together and end up competing in various ways. And, you know, I think the best illustration of this is, you know, Eric Schmidt was on Apple's board for a long time and then had to step down basically after the launch of Android because all of a sudden Google and Apple were competing very directly in making smartphone operating systems. And, you know, Google stayed on the iPhone. It still is on the iPhone, as the default search engine, for example, for a long time. But, you know, slowly Apple stripped out things like Google Maps. They've taken YouTube away as a kind of default pre-installed app. They've kind of had obviously a well-documented history of competing and some fairly aggressive back and forth. You know, Steve Jobs famously talked about thermonuclear war and so on. So they do compete, but they're very different companies still, and they're coming at it from a very different place. You know, Google's motivation in making Android is very different from Apple's motivation in creating iOS and sustaining it. And so the question is just, you know, do those things continue to compete, and does it matter? And, you know, these are the two dominant smartphone operating systems and tablet operating systems, for that matter, in the world at the moment, and that's a reality. And so the two are competing, and you know their features have to compete with each other in order to keep their respective platforms interesting. The big difference, though, is the way they go to market. So Google obviously takes Android to market primarily through OEMs, so device manufacturers that license Android.
Who are not making any money, by the way.
Who for the vast majority of cases, other than Samsung, really aren't making any money.
Right.
You know, whereas Apple obviously takes it to market, but not as an independent product, but as a tightly integrated part of these, you know, hardware products like iPhone and iPad and so on. And so very different approaches to market. And that's Apple's differentiation, is they're all about creating the best possible product. And Google's all about trying to maximize the advertising opportunity. And so their motivations are very different. That leads them to make very different decisions. And from a user perspective, there are very different trade-offs. You know, you have a million and one different options for Android smartphones that they all come tightly integrated with Google and will, you know, use your usage of those services in order to serve your advertising. You know, Apple will sell you a premium product that you'll really have to pay a premium for, but, you know, its sole motivation is to have you be happy with that product and try to sell you another one a little way down the line. And so they need to make it as good as possible. So, you know, you might pay more for one option in dollars. With the other one, you're paying with your attention and your interests and so on that they then use to serve up advertising. And so from a consumer perspective, you have to decide, you know, which of those things is more important to you, and understand the trade-offs that you're making when you go either way.
That's a good point. I wish I could talk to you for another hour. This has been fascinating. But unfortunately, we're out of time. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show. Listeners, if you want to learn more about Jan and Jackdaw Research, Jan, tell the listeners where they can find you.
Yeah, so if you're on Twitter, I'm Jan Dawson, so Jandawson on Twitter. Jackdaw Research is at just jackdawresearch.com. I also blog on TechPinion, so that's another good place to find me, and do the TechPinions podcast as well as a podcast on my own website, which is Beyond Devices.
And you also have a newsletter at Jackdaw. People can sign up to and get weekly reports.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Cool. Well, thank you very much again, as I said,
for being
on the show. This has been fascinating. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.